Welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell. Ryan Bailey will not be with us today. He's off, I guess, wandering around Europe. So instead, I'll be taking over his hosting duties. Joining me on this weekend review are two fellows. Up first, a man who genuinely has me thinking we should all be watching the Balloon World Cup. Graham Ruthven, hello. And thank you for introducing me to the most mesmerizing thing I have seen in a while.
I mean, we're working off the assumption that that is what Ryan is away covering, aren't we?
I mean, he should be, and I hope so. And if he's not, shame on him.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is incredible, and I'm not kidding. Like, I want to watch. I hope Sky Sports pick up the live rights for the next iteration of the Balloon World Cup, because yeah. I just love how they set it up in as a living room, like a living
That's
room
ridiculous.
In a squash court, which perfectly emulates how I used to play this game with yep. my brother as a kid. This could have been my calling.
It really, like, for people who haven't seen it, which is probably most people, because I only saw it because Graham said it to me this morning. It really is exactly as he just described, except also with a small SUV in there as well. But it's just two guys trying to keep a balloon alive. You have one hit. If it touches the ground, I guess you lose a point, or the other player gains a point. But it was one of those things where I started watching and thought, like, oh, this is kind of cute. And then became really rapidly invested in like the strategy and the tactics, the frustration when it gets caught on the car and that allows the other player to catch up. Graham, I really mean it. Thank you for the introduction to Balloon World Cup.
No problem. I also assume this is going to be a TSS spin-off when the next Balloon World Cup happens, like the Euros. We'll be doing it every day.
I mean, I feel like there aren't enough podcasts out there, so let's get a podcast about the Balloon World Cup. Joining us today is a fella who doesn't get as exciting of an introduction, because instead of watching the Balloon World Cup, he was just crossing off names on the MLS playoff list. It's Joe Lowry. Hi, Joe. Are you tired of line drawing?
Slightly. No, I'll never get tired of line drawing, especially when I do it with Balloon World Cup footage playing in the background. Because I'm not going to lie to you guys. I was just watching that Yay! Clip on repeat while you and Graham were talking just then, Taylor. I will confirm you get a point when you hit the balloon, to the ground before your opponent can get underneath it and bap it back up in the air. And I'm also encouraged to hear that, Graham, at least you played this game growing up, Taylor. I don't know if you did or not, but this feels like something that permeated every household at some point.
Oh, yeah. And then there's furniture broken. There's loud noises coming from upstairs.
Right.
The parents respond. Yeah, I think those all – that should be part of the distraction phase, is one of the player's parents just screaming at them from off court about how they're making too much noise. You got to add in the real-life distractions to make it realistic.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Mine is the car. When I played as a kid, there wasn't a car. And to anyone who hasn't seen this, just to explain, I think the car is there for sponsorship purposes, but it actually – is a really interesting obstacle where it's like this, it's just big enough to get round so you can stop the balloon hitting the ground, but it there's a tactical element to it being in the middle of the room.
I think you're absolutely right that it is a sponsorship agreement. But I also like to think that it's just representative of the people who played this game in their garage growing up. And so you have to have the car in there. You got to work around the car. You also have a living room set up. You got to work around there. I appreciate that they are wearing helmets and no other protective padding. Those shins feel like the things that would be most in pain. But I feel like we've gone long on the Balloon World Cup. Maybe too long, perhaps?
Never too long. Come on.
I appreciate that. So on this episode, we will be rounding up the action in England, Germany, Spain, and Italy, taking a look at a few matches in detail. Let's begin with the Premier League, where Liverpool hit Norwich 4-5, Chelsea and City kept their title aspirations alive, and Manchester United did the opposite of thrive. I may have used that one before, but it continues to apply. Jamie Vardy had a party, while Manchester United's defense was anything but hearty. Rashford made it 2-2 late, but conceding 15 seconds later sealed Manchester United's fate. The match was momentarily hard-fought. Graham Ruthven, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, that was an excellent Ryan Bailey impression, so
thank you, sir. There weren't enough double entendres, but aside from that, I'll take it.
Not enough Scotland roasts, Taylor, either, just as a note of criticism.
No Scotland roasts and no innuendos in there, but other than that, it was spot on. Taylor, are you sure you want to talk about this match?
Nope. No, I'm not.
This was a bizarre performance by Manchester United, and I wrote this over the weekend. To me, this was the game that This was the game that Solskjaer finally lost control of the situation at Manchester United. And even though I didn't expect him to get sacked on, you know, on Monday morning as the chant go, I don't even expect that he'll get sacked in the coming weeks. But I do believe that we're now, this is the beginning of the end for him as Manchester United manager. And we'll look back at this game as, I remember a Moyes match where Man United drew 2-2 at home to Fulham. And I think looking back, I think that was in February. And he obviously wasn't sacked until April, but really that match was the end for him. And I think we might look back at this match as the end for Solskjaer. I don't know what their approach was. The thing that was most bizarre for me was their pressing plan or lack thereof.
Yeah.
Out of possession, it seemed to me that they were in a 4-2-4, which suggested that they did want to press high, but those advanced positions from the front four didn't actually translate into any actual high press. And that just meant Leicester could pass around them very easily. And that left the midfield completely exposed. And time again, Leicester were just arrowing passes from either deep midfield or their defence into advanced positions where Leicester could turn and run at Manchester United. And there are a lot of different explanations for that. I think there's a good deal of analysis needed. It would be easy to blame Ronaldo, I guess, and it's certainly true that he doesn't press from the front. I've seen statistics from The Athletic that shows he's pretty much the worst presser in the league, but it feels like it's more than just one player. And even when United did press a little bit higher up the pitch, I mean, Mason Greenwood was at least trying at times, there was just no coordination. So when Greenwood was pressing high on Soyuncu, there was no one backing him up, and I just found it very easy, or Leicester, I should say, found it very easy to play through this Man United team.
Graham, listening to the BBC and their coverage of this game in the weekend's action, they were all sort of discussing how safe Ole is, how he's not going to be sacked. We know he's not going to be sacked in the way that, like, Joe and I talked about Greg Berhalter. Not that he shouldn't be, not that there shouldn't be that conversation, but just that it felt like the powers that be, the higher ups, were never going to pull that trigger, at least not yet. It seems like you sort of feel the same. Why do you think Ole might be kept around? The Moyes example you drew, I think, was the speculation was that they wanted to wait until he was mathematically unable to qualify for the Champions League, and then they could sack him and not have to pay him out nearly as much. I don't know if that's the case here, but it does seem like fans think, okay, enough is enough, the time has come, and pundits seem to think, give it a few more weeks, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think the most damning thing about Solskjaer now is he's not learning from his mistakes. And previously I've defended Solskjaer because I felt like he was learning on the job as an elite level manager, and he was improving in certain respects. You know, Man United did get better at breaking down low defensive blocks and opposition teams. Now it feels like his team selection is all over the place. He's getting his midfield wrong in every single game. So for me, that is the thing that, as much as the results, contributes to my opinion that it's pretty much done for him as Manchester United manager, because I don't see those signs of improvement anymore. I think with Moyes, yeah, it was a contractual situation. They sacked him the morning after a defeat to Everton, which I think meant they couldn't qualify for the top four. And so that just feeds into this idea that the Glazers don't make a move until they absolutely have to. The one exception with that is Mourinho, who they did actually sack earlier than I thought they would. I thought Mourinho would get a full season, and they sacked him in November, was it, Taylor? Around about November time?
It was pretty early.
Yeah, so, but that was maybe because Mourinho made the environment so toxic that the Glazers felt they had to get rid of him. That is maybe the thing that will save Solskjaer. I don't think the players, I know there were some questionable comments from Pogba after the match where he talks about something needs to change. I actually don't think he was meaning Solskjaer. I think Pogba and Solskjaer's relationship is actually one of the stronger ones in the dressing room, and one of the reasons Pogba continues to play reasonably well for Manchester United despite this contract situation. So I don't think the players, there's going to be a revolt. I don't think even Old Trafford's going to get that toxic, yeah, because I think a lot of Man United fans recognise Solskjaer as a bit of a club hero. It's Twitter that is a lot more toxic around Solskjaer. So that's all to say, I don't anticipate the Glazers making a move on Solskjaer. It wouldn't surprise me if they gave him the whole season, and then when they fall out of the top four, which at the moment seems likely, that's maybe when they would make a move.
And it's such a shame, guys, in a way, when you look at the talent that this Manchester United team has, and you can see it on some of their goals in this game, the first one especially, the talent they have is just absurd, right? You have Pogba playing next to Matic in this 4-2-3-1 in this game. You've got Bruno Fernandes as that 10, and then Jadon Sancho on one side and Ronaldo and Mason Greenwood on the other, Ronaldo up top and Mason Greenwood on the right side in that 4-2-3-1/4-4-2. The talent is just absurd, and I can't help but get the feeling, Graham, I love how you highlighted some of their pressing struggles in this game. I think there were struggles in possession, in build-up, and in how Manchester United attempted to control this game at all. They did it in spurts, and they get a lovely goal from Mason Greenwood in the 19th minute that comes from a bit of possession. But even on that sequence, they're not really ever threatening to drive into the box and create consistent chances. Yes, they got into the box at times in this game. Ronaldo was very quiet in the first half and got some touches in dangerous spots in the second half. But you can't help but get the feeling when you watch this team that there's something holding the players back instead of allowing them a platform to play upon and actually grow from. And I think there's a realistic explanation where that thing is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
And Joe, we talked about this when we were talking about the U.S. and how there are shades of Manchester United to the way the United States national team plays, that sometimes they're very good, sometimes they're very poor, and it's tough to know what is kind of feeding one and what is leading to the other. But I agree with Graham that it doesn't seem like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is really learning lessons from game to game or improving his team. All of this begs the obvious question. Joe, would Tyler Adams make this team more functional? Because we've had this conversation before, and I want to be clear, I do not mean it in jest. Manchester United need a mobile number six. I think we've talked a little bit about his limitations playing forward, but I think he can do a good enough job. But I think he covers ground, he puts out fires, he does the defensive work that maybe nobody else is capable of. I genuinely think he makes this team better. Joe, I look forward to you dunking on that theory.
No, and we've had this discussion before, and I have somewhat changed my tune, Taylor. I do think Tyler Adams would help this team in a way that a Band-Aid would help a more serious wound that wouldn't actually help the wound, right? He would do something, and I think you like him as a Matic understudy slash replacement in that similar role where you have defensive responsibilities. Matic is smoother on the ball than I think a lot of folks give him credit for. So you have this not all-around midfielder, but a slightly more defensively inclined midfielder who can also do some things on the ball. You have that, and you like that next to Pogba if Pogba's playing as that other number eight in the 4-2-3-1. But none of those things, none of those tweaks or adjustments really overhaul anything. And I think there are things that need to be overhauled, guys.
I do have some sympathy for Solskjaer in that it feels like this squad is a real puzzle. And I'm not sure if there's an answer. I don't know if there is a winning team in this squad. Despite the fact they have so much talent, it feels really imbalanced. However, that sympathy only extends so far because, of course, this is a squad that Solskjaer has assembled, and so he should maybe have thought of that before now. But he does have some difficult decisions to make, and when I was thinking about this in my research, I think actually his only real route out of this situation, he has to sacrifice someone for the sake of some balance and structure. And I think Pogba is the easiest player to drop, despite the fact that he has started the season well. Obviously, he had, what did he have, like 100 assists in his first five games or something like that? So I'd be going for a front three of Rashford, Ronaldo and Sancho. Rashford is a good person to lead the press, and Sancho knows how to press from his Dortmund days, and those two compensate for Ronaldo. Then I'd be going for a midfield three of Fernandes, who can back up the press from midfield, with a two of Matic, Fred, McTominay and Van de Beek. Let's not forget about him. And 4-3-3 is the system that Van de Beek worked. He worked so well in at Ajax. And Man United don't just need a midfield destroyer. They need someone, when Joe's talking about possession play there, which was an issue in this game against Leicester, they need someone who can take the ball under pressure and spin it on. And I think Van de could be that player. So I think there is a system that, I don't know if it's a team that wins the title, but certainly maybe gets Man United out of this situation. But it requires Solskjaer to make some really difficult decisions, because then, of course, that team I mentioned, there's no place for Greenwood, who's maybe been their best player this season. There's no place for Cavani. Pogba's on the bench. So it's not easy, whichever way you look at it.
Graham, I think you are probably correct that they will continue to give Ole time. Maybe they give him the whole season. That said, much has been made of the fact that they've got Atalanta this week in the Champions League. Then they've got a very informed Liverpool next weekend. If he doesn't get any points there, it does seem like maybe those are easy ways to kind of attack Solskjaer. But at the same time, I think it's easy to defend against, like, oh, it's the Champions League, it's always difficult, it's Liverpool, they're one of the best teams in England. I think I wouldn't agree with that necessarily, because I don't want to lose to either of those clubs. But what do you think would be the thing that has him out the door? What do you think he can do to save himself? And Joe, I'll come to you for the same question after Graham.
I think in terms of what he can do to save himself, just going back to my previous answer, he needs to make some big decisions on what his first team is, because Rashford comes off the bench here, makes a bit of an impact. So is he in the first team? I think Solskjaer needs to settle on what a team is and work on the relationships, because that's part of the problem. Is I don't see, for instance, Pogba and Ronaldo, there's no relationship between those two players, despite the fact they should be on a similar wavelength. That should be something Man United can build around. So Solskjaer needs to get players on the pitch, work on the relationships. In terms of what could push him out the door, I'm not sure anything pushes him out the door, but I think an absolute mauling at the hands of Liverpool next weekend would really, really ramp up the pressure to the point where maybe another couple defeats on the back of that could maybe do the job.
Joe, any disagreement?
No, I guess I'm slightly more pessimistic about this whole thing. I don't think, picking a team and having those players work together and building the relationships within the squad would obviously help things to an extent. I just have no faith that Ole is going to be able to turn this group into a group that plays cohesive title-winning soccer or title-contending soccer. Really, we just haven't seen it with the ball. We haven't seen it against the ball. I think a pattern we've seen from Manchester United this season, though, in terms of their results, is they lose to teams that have quality and they beat teams that they have a lot more talent than. And in this game, they had more talent than Leicester on a, you know, like for like level, but Leicester have a cohesive plan right now under Brendan Rodgers. They actually have a tactical approach in possession and with their pressing. And when Manchester United enter those games, they haven't done well this season. And I don't really see that turning around at any point in the near future, regardless of what changes Ole makes to this group.
And Joe, it is fair to then point out that I'm a Man United fan, so I feel like it's always going to happen, but we've done the thing of talking about the team that lost as opposed to the team that won. And you're absolutely right. Leicester looked better in this game, looked like they had a more cohesive game plan and had just fight from beginning to end, exemplified by Jamie Vardy drawing that foul in injury time that leads to the fourth goal. He's running everywhere. He's covering all the ground. We should probably take a moment to have some praise or a bit more praise for Leicester before we move on.
They were excellent. They were so, so good, I thought. They were in this 3-4-1-2 shape that also looked like a 3-5-2 sometimes, as James Maddison would drop back into midfield to be an 8 across from Yuri Tielemans. It also sometimes looked like a 3-4-2-1 where Kelechi Iheanacho and Maddison would be kind of the two inside forwards underneath Jamie Vardy. I thought the shape worked really well, and more important than that, of course, is the style that they used. They were comfortable in build-up. They had really great distribution from the central defensive midfield. They were willing to be patient on the ball, but they were also vertical at times, taking advantage of the gaps that Manchester United would give them. I was in love with Tielemans in this game, and more than that, I was in love with how he and Maddison combined. They're just a joy to watch together. There's a sequence in the 40th minute, guys, where Maddison and Tielemans combine on the left side for Leicester. James Maddison drops in from his kind of 10 spot, then plays it to Tielemans. Tielemans bounces it right back to Maddison. And then as soon as he's let the ball go off his foot, Tielemans just sort of drifts forward between Manchester United's lines, and Maddison returns it to him. And just like that, between the two of those players, Leicester have broken into the attack with some clever combination play, some clever movement from Yuri Tielemans. It's a phenomenal bit of soccer, and there's great goals in this game from Tielemans and a nice goal from Soyuncu to go ahead in the 78th minute, and some good sequences. The end of this game was just insane, right? Jamie Vardy's goal, and then Manchester United have a goal, and Patson Daka has a goal, not in that order, but it's unreal, and Leicester deserve a lot of credit after a pretty poor start to the season by their standards and I think a lot of the expectations. They'd only won 4 out of 11 games this season headed into this one, but they were phenomenal here, and I think they deserve a ton of credit for winning this one 4-2.
The difference in the coaching between Leicester and Manchester United is incredible, and we've spoken, Joe, you mentioned they're the high press from Leicester. It's not just in the players who are leading that high press. Obviously, Vardy's very good at that and Maddison backs up, but their defensive line recognizes when that press is happening as well, and they push up. And so that means that if Manchester United, on the odd occasion that they did ping a few passes around that Leicester high press, they're into the midfield, but the midfield is really congested because Leicester have got that high line and they've got players like, you know, Tielemans and Didi, so on, who can just pick the possession off. And that is a big difference between Leicester and Manchester United, because Manchester United, it just felt like Matic and Pogba as that midfield two had so much space to cover, not just laterally, but between the midfield and the defence, so that when Leicester were pinging those passes in behind them, they had so much space to run into, and Man United just didn't have that against the Leicester defence.
Graham, a very easy question to answer for you. Why Johnny Evans good and Harry Maguire bad?
I think that might come down to coaching again. Sorry to put everything at Solskjaer's door. I keep saying I've been maybe more defensive of Solskjaer than most.
Yeah.
But defensively has always been his weakness. Even when things have been going good in the attacking sense, it just feels like he can't build a cohesive defensive plan. And Harry Maguire, his problems were just compounded by the fact he was clearly rushed back from injury for this match. That was another thing that you could blame Solskjaer for. He actually held his hands up a little bit after full time and said, if we concede four goals, then maybe I've made a couple of bad decisions. And that was one of his bad decisions. Maguire just didn't look sharp at all. I mean, particularly for the Tielemans goal, which is obviously an exceptional finish and might be goal of the season. The way he takes that, he totally means it to chip De Gea into the far corner. But the way that ball is given up, I don't know why Maguire is waiting for that pass to come to him. I understand he maybe wants to hold on to the ball, but there's also a sharpness in recognising the situation that you have two Leicester players in front of you. And in that situation, there are times when you just have to take a few steps towards the ball and thump it up the pitch to get it away from danger. If he feels he can't get a pass away to keep possessions, and he just didn't make that recognition at all.
All right, I'm going to go have a quick cry and, you know, contemplate existence. And then we'll be back to talk Bayern Munich, who are a good team that can get results. But more in just a moment. First, a word from today's sponsors.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help you find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn, though, isn't just a job board. It helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. Speaking from experience, hiring for a small business, it's difficult when you're wearing so many hats. You might not have the time or the resources to hire. LinkedIn makes it very easy to complete the job hiring process. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. Comes very well recommended from this guy. And also 2.5 million small businesses who are using LinkedIn for hiring. On LinkedIn, did you know 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours? That's a quick turnaround to hire professionals on LinkedIn. So post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Bundesliga. We shall go where Dortmund kept their second place status alive with a 3-1 win over Mainz. Surprisingly, Erling Haaland did not score a goal in that game because he scored two. Freiburg and Leipzig drew 1-1, meaning Freiburg are in the European places and Leipzig remain mid-table. But we're going to focus on Bayern Munich's first half destruction of Bayer Leverkusen, a result that had the hosts needing some brand name headache medication. Joe, what did Bayern do to rip this team apart aside from just being Bayern Munich, or was that sort of the answer?
So it's sort of the answer, right? You think about the talent differential between these two teams. Leverkusen are missing a couple of players, specifically in central midfield, which hurts them in a game like this. You have the talent advantage, certainly. I was surprised to see Alphonso Davies start in this game after he started three matches with Canada over World Cup qualifying and the international break, and then he does exit the first half with a slight hamstring injury. Maybe he wouldn't have left that game if Bayern hadn't been so dominant. But either way, you know, Bayern Munich have a clear talent advantage here, and that's huge. I think at times I can understate that and get too lost in the tactical side. Having better players is a great way to win soccer games. It's the best way to win soccer games. And Bayern do that every single year, and they win the title a lot. And that makes a lot of sense. So there's the personnel side of things, but there is also the tactical side of things. Man, this team, I thought, executed their game plan really well. They didn't come in to totally dominate possession, but they got a lot of clever pressure on the ball. They sat in this 4-4-2 mid-block with the wingers pushed up just a little bit to make it look almost like a 4-2-2-2, but not fully vertical like the 4-2-2-2 tends to be. They're in this 4-4-2 block or some relation to that block, and they're pushing up to try and win the ball when the ball goes wide or on back passes, or they are just setting up in a high press. And Leverkusen had real trouble playing through that pressure. The Bayern's defensive press leads to the first goal, leads to the third goal indirectly, but still leads to those moments. They were causing Leverkusen real problems with that defensive work. And then with the ball, guys, so fluid, right? Bayern under Nagelsmann and dating back to Hansi Flick, a lot of times it's a base 4-2-3-1 shape, right? It's Thomas Müller underneath Lewandowski. We've seen this story 1,000 times. But it's fluid in how they attack under Nagelsmann, just like it was at times under Hansi Flick. There's probably more rotations this year than last, though. You've got that double pivot with Kimmich and Goretzka, and Kimmich would then just be the solo six, and Goretzka would push forward. And then one of the wingers would tuck in, and Thomas Müller would drift to the side, and then Nicolas Sula would drop and stay as one of the center backs, and Sané or Gnabry would stay deeper on that side. And it was just hard for Leverkusen to track and to keep up with, and Bayern Munich just ripped them to shreds over and over and over again.
The fourth goal basically being Bayern winning the ball back, and 5 seconds later it's in the back of the net, and in that time they travel, I think, from midfield to scoring from like the tap in from Gnabry. It's a very clever tap in. It's a great run, but just the ruthless efficiency of the way Bayern attack always makes me very impressed. And then this felt very much like it was going to finish 5-1, even though it was 5-0 at halftime, because Bayern would sort of ease off, go into cruise control, sort of. Maybe Leverkusen would be able to get the one, and it finishes as it did. Graham, with that said, it seems like there's been a little bit of soul-searching in Germany in response to this result.
There has. When I was looking through the German press this morning and research for this podcast, and I know we all joke about Bayern Munich's dominance of German soccer and how the Bundesliga is a one-team league, but there is a genuine discussion in German soccer circles about what can be done about their dominance. Obviously, this was billed as a top of the table clash between two teams that were tied on points before kickoff, and by full time, we just had another illustration of of how it's all an illusion and how much stronger Bayern Munich are than anyone else. And I am very confident in saying there's no chance anyone else is going to win that title this season. Might as well give it to Bayern Munich right now. They're so much stronger. Not only do they have the strongest squad, but oh, they also added the best, the sharpest tactician in the whole country to their ranks as well over the summer. So there has been talk. I saw one article talking about redistributing some of the Champions League revenue more evenly. I even saw in another article a suggestion of getting rid of the fabled and famous 50+1 rule to try and attract more investment to other clubs. That seems unlikely, but the fact that that's being talked about and being considered tells you that there is concern in Germany over how the Bundesliga is becoming a one-team league and how Bayern Munich just can't be stopped. Their advantage financially and just in terms of the culture at that club as well, I think they have the strongest culture of any club in Europe, for my money. That just gives them an unassailable advantage.
Graham, sticking with the culture aspect for a second, like, what specifically do you mean? Because for me, what I came away from was the idea that when you come into this Bayern team, say somebody like Upamecano, who is a good defender, was a good defender for Leipzig, but had issues. And I talked to multiple people who would talk about how sometimes he looked excellent, sometimes he looked really poor. One friend of mine who watches like every single game, he might even watch more than you, Graham, I don't know how, was arguing that like he had never seen Upamecano put in a full 90-minute performance. He goes to Bayern, and I would say he did exactly that against Leverkusen. And I thought this is one of his more standout games. And it did make me wonder if there is an idea of coming into a club like Bayern, there's just a confidence to every single player that's there that when you're not winning or when you go a goal down, there's just a belief of like, ah, we'll figure it out. We'll find a way through. And if you have everybody sort of bought into the idea of don't worry, we'll end up getting a goal, and maybe an element of the like, don't worry, they will end up being afraid of us and we will be able to have opportunities. It does just seem like there is a mentality that is pervasive to Bayern Munich as an organization that means you can have individuals come in and not lead to wholesale change or things falling apart like you do with other larger clubs when they bring in bigger and bigger names and poach bigger and bigger talent. I wonder how much of that mentality is just the confidence of winning, and winning consistently means that you expect to win, means that you're never too worried when you're not 1-0 up inside the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, there's a few strands to the culture that I spoke about. So the first one, which maybe relates most directly to what you're talking about there, is just the culture of winning that is at that club, and the fact that the legends stick around and they play roles in executive positions, and there's sort of an expectation. Weirdly, Bayern Munich, they find a way to stop that from becoming a crushing expectation. Like a lot of clubs, you think of like Sir Alex Ferguson looking out over David Moyes when he was at Manchester United. It felt like that expectation was crushing on Moyes rather than it didn't embolden him in any way, whereas Bayern Munich have their legends embolden the current players and the current manager and so on. The other thing about Bayern Munich and their culture is it feels like everything in German soccer gravitates towards them, whether that is signings or managers like Julian Nagelsmann. It is just seen as the pinnacle of German soccer, and I use Manchester United as an example again. Kind of like Man United in the late 90s, you know, they go out and sign Andy Cole, they go out and sign Roy Keane from Nottingham Forest. Like, they just go out, they hoover up the best players from around Germany. I know a lot has been made of that. But then the other thing, I have this theory about football clubs with money, in that the thing that stops them is always complacency and incompetence. And football clubs don't tend to run like regular businesses. And if you look at things like tech companies, the money gives them more power to go out and get the best people. And they recognize how important it is to get the best people into their company. And it just makes their advantage bigger and bigger and bigger. Football clubs don't tend to do that, but I feel like Bayern Munich do that. So they use their advantage. Not only do they have that advantage, they use that advantage to get the best people in, both on and off the pitch, to the club. And it just makes it very difficult for anyone to, you know, even a club like Dortmund, with the talent that they've got, with the stature of the club that they have, the history they have, it feels like they can't compete with Bayern Munich at the moment. So I do understand why in Germany there is this discussion of maybe changing things a little bit to level the playing field.
Joe, have you been surprised by how good Bayern has looked under Julian Nagelsmann? Because I thought there would be more of a buying in period. I thought maybe he'd have to get some of the veterans on board with the pressing, with the intensity of his system, with the specificity of his instructions that he's giving. I wasn't sure how well it would go over. because Bayern to me had an air of a club that just sort of, we know how we want to play. Don't overcomplicate this. Let us do what we do. And if anything, they look just as good or better. They seem to have found a hybrid approach that works. So I continue to be surprised by how smoothly it's gone so far. Where are you on that one?
I'm not all that surprised, honestly, Taylor. I think a lot of the conversation around Julian Nagelsmann in the past has been slightly overblown, probably just because it's easy for us to let some of this stuff get out of control. But man, this team, just the talent they have, I keep coming back to this. It's unreal. And Julian Nagelsmann, he has come in and changed some things, right? I talked about how the possession is a little bit more fluid than it's been in the past and all of that kind of stuff. But I don't know that there have been dramatic changes. It's still the same base shape. It's still largely the same squad. And if you're coming in and trying to overhaul that, that's probably not the best idea. And I don't think that Nagelsmann has done that necessarily. I'd have to dig into the pressing numbers, but I would be surprised if there's been a dramatic uptick in how Bayern Munich press this year relative to how they did last year under Hansi Flick. Nagelsmann's Leipzig teams didn't really press all that much compared to Rangnick or Jesse Marsch or anything like that. So I don't know how many changes we've actually seen. And I think the players they brought in, we saw bits of Upamecano and Marcel Sabitzer in this game. Upamecano starting and Sabitzer coming off the bench in the second half. They've even strengthened a lot of this squad with some key players in the last decade.
What a joke, guys.
It's ridiculous, right? I mean, you see so much talent here. I'm not all that surprised that it's been a borderline dominant season so far from Bayern Munich. They haven't been perfect in every single game and they have had their struggles, but we can see in a game like this just how dominant they really can be.
I struggle to think of a club. I guess like maybe Real Madrid and Barcelona are like this, but clubs that are just so huge and have such consistent records of success that players like Sabitzer will go there to be a bench player because it means, yeah, they're going to get minutes, they'll start a game here and there, but they're going to win silverware and they're going to be playing for this juggernaut of a club. I can't really blame them. It does just feel unfair. How about this, Joe? We have like the draft in American sports where the worst teams get rewarded. We have like the allocation order in Major League Soccer. I always want to call it allocation disorder. What if in the Premier League, the team with like the highest, I don't know, dysfunction rating gets to just poach one player or coach from Bayern Munich every season? Does that restore parity if Manchester United could just swap Nagelsmann and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer right now, or whoever is top of the ranking could just come in and pick up Thomas Müller and swap him in for one of their underperforming midfielders? I feel like that's the way we bring about parity in the Bundesliga while making the Premier League even more dominant than it already is.
Well, I was going to say, maybe if we're looking for parity in the Bundesliga, maybe we just take the players from Bayern and give them to the other players in the Bundesliga, not necessarily the Premier League. But right, Taylor, if this is your elaborate plan to rescue Manchester United, I'm not going to stand in your way.
You may have spotted some things. You may have spotted some things. Let's go to Italy, where Napoli handed Torino a 1-0 loss that kept the Neapolitans top of the table for another week. 8 games, 8 wins, happy times for them. Less so for Torino, although they were photographed bringing home a pallet of mozzarella, so at least they have that to look forward to.
Is that real? Is that real, Taylor?
It's real. There's a photo of their bus with a giant pallet of, I wasn't sure what it was, but it's all cellophane wrapped cheese that they were bringing home.
We have buried the lead. We have buried the lead
I was going to mention how Napoli wore a Halloween kit for this match, but yeah, that is the lead, how Torino went home with a feast of mozzarella.
It's at least 100 pounds of cheese, if not more. I will try to find the photo for you both. Milan also got a win to keep pressure on Napoli. Juventus bested Roma 1-0 to pull within touching distance of the top four. But we are going to spend some time with Lazio 3, Inter 1. This game had a lot of drama before, during, and after. Inter Milan, take a 1-0 lead off of an early penalty. Lazio able to pull some goals back and get the 3-1 win. Joe, let's start with that idea for a second, because Inter in this one playing the more familiar back three to them under Simone Inzaghi, former Lazio manager, we should note. They're kind of sticking with a lot of what worked for them last season, but then there are the adjustments. But I'm drawing that parallel to then point out that this Lazio team are switching to a back four under Maurizio Sarri. There was much made in the commentary of how they're still figuring out how to play, how best to utilize his system, or how best to execute his system. And it did not feel like they were going to be getting the win here. At halftime, it seemed like this was going to end up being a comfortable Inter Milan victory, and it was anything but that by the end. So, Joe, how did Lazio get back into this game?
That's a great question, Taylor, because Inter were dominant I thought, in the first half and even extending into the beginning of the second half. So I want to talk about what went wrong for Lazio first and right for Inter, and then we'll flip the script and try to figure out how this game changed.
I like that part.
Inter start in this 3-5-2, right? And you've got Brozovic as the six in front of the three center backs. You got two eights in front of him, and then the front two and the wing backs, right? We've seen them use that shape plenty, as you mentioned, Taylor. So they're in this 3-5-2, and Lazio, for them, they're in this 4-3-3 shape that we associate with Maurizio Sarri in large respect. And so they're in that 4-3-3, Inter's in this 3-5-2, and the X factor, as I saw it in this game, was Brozovic, Inter Milan's number six. Because if you think about putting these two shapes on top of each other, imagine you're overlaying them. You've got the back three for Inter, and maybe the front three for Lazio, and then you've got the number six for Inter, who is Brozovic. And with the way that Lazio chose to set themselves up defensively under Sarri, the way that he organized his Lazio team, Sarri, you have this triangle for Lazio, but the triangle's facing the wrong way, really, because Inter have a deep point and then 2 points in front of that point. So you've got an equilateral triangle where the tip is at the bottom. Lazio's triangle is oriented in a way in which they have a number six and two eights in front of them. So they have the equilateral triangle with the point at the bottom. There's no one touching Brozovic here. That's the point. There's no one stepping to him. There's no one who knows, this is my job to go out and press. If Lazio were in a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-4-2, someone would have a clear responsibility and know, okay, I'm supposed to step to Brozovic, or I'm supposed to use my cover shadow to mark him out of the game. Instead, with Lazio, they just sat back. Their midfield didn't really ever step forward and pressure Brozovic, which just let Inter spray diagonal balls out to the wingbacks over and over again. There, you can see that in the build-up to their first goal, their only goal, Inter. And then you can see it again in the 21st minute, again in the 21st minute, so twice in that spell, and twice again in the 31st minute. I just stopped tracking this because it happened so many times. Lazio could never get a grip on this game. They could never fully establish possession because Inter kept playing through them on repeat in this game, and they couldn't figure out how to change it. Finally, in the second half, Taylor, I think we see some changes from Sarri, where you had Pedro and Felipe Anderson as the wingers in this game. And Pedro started stepping forward alongside Immobile more often. And it did look like a 4-4-2, at least in moments. And that helped a little bit block off service into Brozovic. But eventually, Lazio just kept the ball. And they said, well, maybe if we can't defend you, we're just going to make it so that we don't have to defend you. And around the 60th minute, Lazio started to get this stranglehold on possession in this game. And we started to see some Sarri ball. We started to see a lot of the combination play that's made Maurizio Sarri a famous manager. The midfielders making those forward runs, the wingers coming back into midfield. And we finally started to see them play their game because they didn't have to worry about defending so much and didn't have to worry about fixing the massive problem in this game. They just sort of changed the circumstances around the game, and they changed the game with their possession. They get some goals. It's not directly from the possession necessarily, but that the difference in how Lazio approached this game and finally deciding to take it, this is a big cliche, but they took it by the scruff of the neck and just kept the ball. I think that had a massive impact on turning the tides in this one.
And if you were spotlighting a couple players for Lazio who you think were instrumental in that turnaround, I'm assuming Felipe Anderson is on that list. I'm guessing Pedro is as well, because I spotted that thing you pointed out of him moving more central, being more of a kind of like second striker option, and just creating problems for Inter. Those two players stood out to me in very good ways. What about you, Joe?
I'm right there with you, Taylor. The wingers, and every time I've watched Lazio this season, the wingers are really important because the way that Sarri likes to create a lot of these combinations is by having so much movement in the front line, specifically with those wingers. The midfielders will go and push up, like Milinkovic-Savic will go and try to break the opposition's back line with a vertical run. And that cues a winger to drop in, or maybe it's the other way around. The winger drops in, and that cues the eight to run forward. Either way, there's a lot of movement. And so those players have to be really aware of when and why they're moving, really. And Pedro, I think, is excellent at that. And every time I've seen him this year, it wasn't perfect in this game. But Pedro has that fluidity in his movement. The same with Felipe Anderson. He's dynamic on the dribble as well. And we can see that on the second goal for Lazio, which is a little bit controversial. There's a lot that goes in there, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But there's a ton of talent in this Lazio team. Milinkovic-Savic is a target on set pieces. He scores that late, not winner, but to extend the lead for Lazio in the 91st minute with a header off of a Luis Alberto free kick. There's a lot of talent in this squad, and it just took a while for it to get on the same page and really take over the game.
There is a lot of talent for Lazio. You are also correct, Joe, that I think Inter and their fans are going to feel as though this was an unfair result, because for the Felipe Anderson goal, the second goal for Lazio, It's an easy rebound off of a Ciro Immobile shot, but the controversial part would be that Inter had had attack of their own, and it was Di Marco playing a ball forward, and then his momentum carries him into a player, slash a player steps into him. That is a foul after the ball has gone, but referee allows the advantage. Inter go down, and I think Lautaro Martinez ends up with a shot that is saved, and then Lazio come back the other way, but Di Marco remains on the ground. They play right past him. They end up getting the goal. Dumfries grabs Felipe Anderson by the neck, somehow doesn't get a red card for that one, or at least I don't think he even gets a yellow card for that one. Graham, do you have any issues with how this goal was scored? I can see why Inter felt like, oh, we didn't know that foul had occurred. We didn't know he was down because we hadn't turned around. But I also really don't feel like Lazio did anything wrong.
I have no issue with this goal whatsoever.
I had a feeling.
Yeah, I obviously the laws of the game are you only stop the match for a head knock, and I think maybe the only exception you would have is if it's so clear that a player has suffered a really bad injury, then you would stop the match. But the fact that Inter have an attack themselves before they then demand that the play is stopped, nope, sorry, you lost any grounds for argument by doing that, and I have absolutely zero issue with Lazio playing on and scoring from this play.
Yeah, Handanovic, the Inter goalkeeper, you could clearly see saying, like, we didn't know they'd played forward. We didn't know he was down. But I have to believe that there were players saying, hey, you've got a guy down. Hey, he's still down. Kick the ball out. Kick the ball out. And they tried to, I guess, but instead the kicking out was saved, which is my way of saying that it wasn't a very good shot. So I don't have much of an issue there. The next question becomes about the red card to Luis Felipe at the end of the game. not Felipe Luis, always worth noting. But I have a theory. A large part of this is because of something that happens in the game, but it's Joaquin Correa subbing on for Inter, the former Lazio player, Joaquin Correa, we should add, who then at the end of the game, Luis Felipe, his former teammate, runs up, kind of jumps on his shoulders in a mock celebration. And I do think he meant it as like a kind of like, you know, lads after the game, whatever. But with the intensity of the match as it was, and with the kind of probably severe swing in emotion for Correa, knowing that he's playing his former club and losing to them, I also think he is the one who is supposed to be marking Sergei Milinkovic-Savic, who scores the third goal and just completely loses him. And that's why SMS is so wide open for that header to get the third goal. And Correa is just standing there knowing he's done something wrong. So even if Luis Felipe, not Felipe Luis, thought that he was just being like a funny guy, I think in that moment he might have come upon Correa being very mad at himself, being very mad at the result and the world, and then having somebody jump on his shoulders and then refuse to let him go in this sort of aggressive but kind of friendly hug. I think I see what Luis Felipe was going for, but I also understand why the red card was given.
It's such a bad misreading of the room.
Yes,
and the context is that Felipe and Correa. I also get the two Correas mixed up as well. I get Felipe Luis and Luis Felipe and Angel Correa and Joaquin Correa. Yep. So it's Joaquin Correa in this one. Yep. The Felipe and Correa are good friends. It's not just that they're former teammates. I read that Felipe was saying afterwards, like their families holiday together and stuff like that. So I think it's quite clear he does mean it in a jovial way. I before we started recording, I compared it to if I was playing fives against a friend and you would maybe kind of jump on their back and go like, well, you know, we've won the match or whatever. But that five-side match is not the same as a competitive Serie A match at the Stadio Olimpico where you're playing your former team and you've maybe just been at fault for the late goal.
Graham or Joe, whoever wants to take this one, I promise this is not toxic masculinity speaking. Always a great way to begin a conversation. I was confused by Luis Felipe crying after getting the red card. And my assumption, mostly confused just because I couldn't quite figure out why he was crying. My assumption is that it's one of those moments where it's like, no, I really didn't mean it that way. I was really just trying to be friendly. And like nobody listening, everybody getting mad and then eventually getting a red card. I'm assuming that's almost like when you say a little kid did something and they didn't, and they don't know how to respond, so they just get really upset and really loud. Like, that's the only thing I can figure, which does have me feeling some sympathy for Luis Felipe, but at the same time, maybe don't jump on the back of your former teammate who has just lost and then things don't go the way they did. Any thoughts on that one?
I don't know, Taylor. This whole situation is so weird. I completely agree with Graham. Right? He just misread the room on a major level. It's just so bizarre. Celebrate with your own team. And jump on your own teammates' backs, and this whole thing won't happen in the first place. I wish I had a greater psychological understanding of what was going on here, because I am legitimately curious, but I do not know.
I took it the same way you did, Taylor. I have to admit, I don't, and again, this is not, you know, toxic masculinity. I don't think I would have cried in that situation, but I can understand why he would be upset. And who knows, you know, with all the, I'm not playing football matches in front of thousands of people and on national television. Who knows? Maybe that sort of thing does get to you, but that's how I took it, was he was very upset that something that he'd done in jest had been taking as, an inflammatory, confrontational thing.
It was also just so strange for people who have not seen. You can find the kind of post-match 4 minutes on YouTube, or at least you could yesterday evening. I don't know if they've been pulled since then. But I guess Lazio, I don't know what their post-match song is, but it seems to be some very flowing, sort of softer, like, song that is sung by the entire ground. And so it was this very, like, mellifluous song with the entire crowd singing, as on the pitch there's just chaos and red cards and tears streaming and players shoving. And it was very much at odds with each other. And I think it made it that much stranger. So a very odd end to that one. We have one more game to be discussed. Hopefully it doesn't end with anybody crying or with us talking about how odd it was. But first, we'll take one more break to hear from today's sponsors.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
Welcome back to La Liga we shall go. Neither Atleti nor Real, neither of the Madrids, played this weekend after receiving special dispensation, since they would have both been missing so many players because South America changed their World Cup qualifying format. I think I have that correct. So for the time being, we're going to talk about Barcelona, who I thought were very, very good. They seemed like a leaner, hungrier, and sort of importantly, angrier team to me, as they got a 3-1 win over Valencia. Graham, we've talked a lot about Barcelona. You and I think, first began our conversations by talking about La Liga,
that's right,
and specifically Barcelona. So I come to you to ask, is Ronald Koeman figuring this team out, or is this just a one-off performance? But I watched this game and just felt like this is a team that seems to have gotten, as I said, like, leaner, hungrier. They seem more bought in. They're willing to get into it physically if they need to, but they're still willing to play good attacking football. I thought this was a very strong result for Barca.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can answer your first question right now. Maybe ask me that in a week's time.
That's
because
fair.
Barcelona have a big game in the Champions League against Dinamo Kiev, which they really need to win if they're to stand any chance of getting out of their group. And then, of course, they have the Clásico against Real Madrid, which will tell us a lot about this group of players. But you're absolutely right. This was better from Barcelona. I think a big part of that is just similar to what Joe was saying about Bayern Munich and the talent differential. Barcelona have players back for this game. Ansu Fati starts his first game since November 2020 and he makes a big difference. So unsurprisingly, better players give you a better chance of winning soccer matches. However, there were a few tactical things from Koeman in this match which were interesting. There had been calls for him to revert to a 4-3-3. A lot has been made of that at Barcelona. We've spoken about that a number of times. And it was reported over the international break that this has become such an issue that Juan Laporta, the Barcelona president, even spoke to Koeman about changing to a 4-3-3. And this was a 4-3-3 of sorts. The one outlier in this is a certain Sergino Dest, whose positioning was interesting, to say the least. He was playing in a more advanced position, but he wasn't even playing as a right midfielder, which would have been interesting in itself. He was playing as a kind of right-sided forward. I can understand why Koeman is looking for a solution on that right side, but to use Dest ahead of Sergio Roberto, who isn't really a right back. So Roberto and Dest were both in the same team, but it was Roberto who was the one playing as the right back and Dest playing as the kind of winger, the forward. Yeah, that was a choice. and I don't think actually, I think it worked to a certain extent. It's just a bit weird to see Dest in that position. They do need someone to provide them some verticality on the right side. And maybe Dest is their best option to do that. Obviously, he approaches the game much like a winger. You know, he's a very attack-minded fullback. And so it wasn't too much of a departure from his normal role, but tactically his positioning was the big talking point from this match, particularly in the first half.
Joe, does Ronald Koeman just want to sow discord in U.S. men's national team ranks? Because that's what I'm assuming. We come away from this international break. We've decided Anthony Robinson is our left back. Sergino Dest is the right back. We know that's where they're going to be. We know that's what gets the best out of them. Then he just comes in this game and looks very good as a right winger. And now I'm concerned that we're going to get a ton of conversations about should he be a right winger for the U.S. national team and should somebody else start at right back.
We've already been getting those conversations, Taylor. They're only going to intensify at
Here
this
we go.
Point.
Thanks, Ronald.
Sergino Dest can do both of those jobs. He could play goalkeeper, right? I mean, players can play in any position. Positions are not like this hard and fast rule to soccer that you can only be in one spot and play there. You can play in a lot of different spots. And Sergino Dest did some good things as a winger in this game. And I think he can do that job for club and country if needed. I still do prefer him in a lot of senses as a fullback, as someone who starts from a deeper position, because I think the timing of those runs that he can do, that he can overlap and provide this last bit of attacking flair, I guess, rather than having to be the one who always initiates those attacks on the wing and is receiving the ball first and then waiting for the overlap instead. I don't know that his skill set fits as well in that winger role because he's already starting up the field. You don't get any sort of dynamic advantage for arriving late or arriving to create a 2v1 or whatever the situation is. It's a different set of circumstances playing as a fullback versus a winger in most situations. That said, I thought he did a pretty good job in this game. He wasn't perfect. There's a moment in the first half where he's on the weak side. He's playing really wide on the right wing and play is on the left and he starts to crash the box and the ball. I think it's from Ansu Fati. It might be from Jordi Alba, but the ball comes across the box and Dest does crash the back post and try to slam it home at the back post, but he's either a little bit late or Valencia do just a great job of clearing the ball. I think it's probably a bit of both, but that was one moment where I said, okay, Sergino Dest maybe isn't wholly used to being in situations like this. So there were things to nitpick. He wasn't totally clean on the ball, but I liked a lot of what I saw from Dest, which does not surprise me because he is a very clever, creative, attacking player.
If it's the same play that I'm thinking of, it's credit to Gaia for sliding into
the last
minute
tackle.
And poking it away, I think, because otherwise, that probably is a tap in there. I watched this one live, and this is where the rewatch is always to your advantage, because when you rewatch, you can see the adjusted tactics, but for the start of this one, I had Dest as the right back and Sergio Roberto as the kind of right-sided midfielder and kept being confused, like, oh, they must be position switching a lot. Oh, they must be swapping a lot. And then slowly realized, like, no, Sergio Roberto is just playing right back and Sergino Dest is further forward. But I thought that was a gamble from Koeman that did work out, and Dest obviously gets the assist for the third goal. But I think maybe Koeman gets less credit for starting Memphis and Ansu Fati because that's kind of obvious. But at the same time, they both looked very good. Graham, was that the best penalty of the season?
It's an absolute corker. it's superb. It's one of the best penalties I've ever seen. There's just absolutely no chance that the goalkeeper saving that. And if he does get behind it, he's going into the net with it. I thought Ansu and Memphis was the biggest positive of this match for Barcelona. There are real signs of a partnership between those two. And I think those two players give Barcelona real hope. They are two very productive players. Ansu, well beyond his years. I think that's been the most startling thing about him is, you know, you get talented teenagers who, particularly in kind of wide, it seems like there's a lot of talented wide forward teenagers. They seem to break through a little bit earlier than others. And it always seems to be their final product that's the last thing they add to their game. But Ansu has had that from the moment he broke into that Barcelona first team. And as obviously he gets the first goal in this game after 13 minutes, as I mentioned earlier, his first start for 11 months after being out through injury. And they, with Ansu and Memphis, they just seem to be on the same wavelength together, which is really good news. Ansu brings intensity, and I can't figure out why he brings intensity. Maybe Joe has a better idea, because it's not like he's leading the high press or anything. He's obviously an outlet on the left side, but there's just more of a zip to Barcelona's play when he's on the pitch. And as soon as he comes off after 58 minutes, everything dropped, including the atmosphere inside the stadium, which I thought was notable given he is very much the Messi of this team now. Fans come to the stadium to watch Ansu Fati play for Barcelona, or I expect they will do over the course of this season. Obviously, they haven't been doing it over the last 11 months. And he is just so important to this Barcelona team. Memphis as well. I think I saw the penalty that he scored was his 50th or 51st direct goal involvement in 2020. It was either the last 12 months or in 2021, which is incredible and just shows how productive he has become. And I didn't expect he would grow into that player when I saw him earlier in his career at Manchester United. But Koeman, as long as he can keep Ansu and Memphis fit, he has something there to build around. There's an attacking hub there, those two players. And I'm not sure how much of it is down to anything that Koeman is actually doing tactically, but sort of in a Solskjaer way of just get your best players on the pitch and they will do something. I think as long as Ansu and Memphis are allowed to do their thing, Barcelona have a chance of at least keeping, I was going to say turn around their season. I don't know about that, but at least kind of keeping their dignity this season.
There are going to be games this season, and maybe this is one of them, well, we are mesmerized by Barcelona. I wasn't mesmerized in this game. I think there's still a lot of flaws that we saw, especially defensively in this one. But there are going to be games where we are just awed by Depay and by Ansu Fati and by maybe even Sergiño Dest overlapping on the right side or just starting higher on the right side in midfield play and young, talented players coming up through the ranks. I mean, all of those things are great, and those games are going to happen, and this game was probably at least adjacent to that category. There are also going to be games where it feels like this team is drowning. And we've already talked about multiple of them this season. And I think that's, again, rooted in the manager and rooted in a lot of the systemic problems in this organization. Ronald Koeman has not shown an ability, a consistent ability, to set this team up in a way that allows them to have a foundation and then build upon that foundation. Did that sound like anyone else we know? Graham, you just mentioned him. It's a very similar situation, I think, managerially with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Ronald Koeman. There is not a real tactical game plan defensively in this game. Barcelona were so weird, right? They're in this man-oriented shape. There's players everywhere. And other coaches, including Marcelo Bielsa and Matias Almeida, do that kind of stuff. They'll have some man-marking defensively. But Barcelona didn't do it well in this game. Pique was getting dragged out and Sergio Roberto was stepping forward, and it just looked really disorganized, and it didn't give Valencia a lot of trouble. I thought they were honestly solid in this game at pretty much everything but creating chances. And so they weren't perfect, but Valencia made Barcelona's life harder than it should have been. So there are still problems with this Barcelona team, and they're going to show up a lot this year. I do think at the same time, we will see some wonderful performances and some really wonderful individual moments, because players like Ansu Fati and Memphis Depay are phenomenal players.
The area of the pitch that it feels like to me Koeman is still not doing enough with is the midfield. And Barcelona now, particularly after the emergence of Gavi, which by the way has been a massive storyline in Spain. He obviously had a very impressive international break with Spain just there. In the Nations League, there's a lot of people really excited about him. So the emergence of Gavi means that Barcelona have Sergio Busquets, who by the way, Gavi seems to have rejuvenated him, particularly for Spain. And there's a growing sense that if you get the right players around Busquets, you get Busquets back to something close to his best. So you've got Busquets, Gavi, Frenkie de Jong, and then of course Pedri to come in. That midfield is potentially one of the strongest midfields in European football. And yet it still feels like there's a lack of control from Barcelona. Taylor, you said, I thought this was good from Barcelona. I thought it was good performance. I think Valencia are a better team than they were last season under Josep Bordalas, and they're a better drilled team, so I do think it was good. But I agree with Joe, I felt watching this game there was a lot of structural problems. They didn't really seem to have much control of large periods of the game. That seems to be an issue for Barcelona, as they can produce good spells within matches, but they never produce a good performance for 90 minutes. And that's what we got here. I thought Carlos Soler had a good game for Valencia. Gonzalo Guedes, if he had been a little bit sharper in front of goal, he could have scored a couple in this match. So there are positive signs for Barcelona in that they're getting better players on the pitch, but still a lot of structural and tactical things that have yet to be resolved.
All right. I mean, everyone is entitled to their opinion. I'm just writing down real quick. Uninvite Joe and Graham from Balloon World Cup viewing party. All right, cool. That's done.
No.
One thing I wanted to spotlight before we end today was Yunus Musah, who subs on in this game, the American international. Joe subs on in more of a central midfield position, more of in like their kind of defensive 4-4-2.
Yes.
He's one of the two central midfielders.
Yes.
But I wanted to spotlight Casey Keller, who was doing the color commentary for this one, blamed Yunus Musah for not tracking Coutinho for the third goal. Felipe Coutinho is wide open. Sergiño Dest plays him in. He finishes easily. Musah is making a play, but making a play very late. I went back and watched this one about 10 times, as I am wont to do. And I will say two things. One, Keller is correct that Musah could have probably been more alive to this one, been more aware that there's a Barca player wide open in the box and gotten to him. But I would add that was not Yunus Musah's man, that he was tracking Jordi Alba on the left, who was making an overlapping run, who was making a very aggressive attacking run. Alba then holds that run up and kind of checks back towards the top of the box, and Musah follows him. Meanwhile, this is the key thing for me, is that Coutinho continues his run, and Guillamon, the central midfielder for Valencia, Coutinho literally runs into him, and Guillamon kind of sidesteps and like continues to walk up the pitch and lets Coutinho just drift right by him. So Musah, who's paying attention to Alba, then spots that there's a wide open player in the box, tries to get to him, but gets there too late. So I just wanted to emphasize that was not entirely Yunus Musah, because I thought otherwise he looked, okay to pretty good in the middle of the park for Valencia. Joe, what did you think of Yunus Musah on the day?
Yeah, if we set that moment in Valencia's own box aside, because Taylor, I think you broke that down well. I didn't have the commentary on for this game, so I didn't have any beef with Casey Keller.
Good choice.
But Musah came on, and I love that he was playing as an eight. That was awesome to see in that double pivot for Valencia. I thought he was trying stuff, man. And I think that fits our understanding of Yunus Musah right now. He comes on and he's willing to take a guy on the dribble and try to break Barcelona down that way. He's also trying to play some aggressive passes, which is, they're not super aggressive line breaking through balls, but he's trying to play forward, and Valencia need that kind of stuff. It fits their style under Bordalas pretty well. Musah wasn't perfect though in the things that he's trying to do, and that's not all that surprising. He's still evolving as a player. He was coming on and trying to push the game forward, but he had a couple of passes that were intercepted. He had a couple of turnovers. That stuff's going to happen. Overall though, I was encouraged. It's this teenager coming on and trying to push a game and inspire a comeback, and I don't know how often we really see that kind of stuff, Taylor.
Graham, your detailed thoughts on Yunus Musah, a player that I know that you know and love and follow diligently?
Well, I've watched him a bit in La Liga, but I have to say I didn't notice him as much in this match as perhaps the two of you did. But given how you track Tyler Adams, maybe it's unsurprising that Yunus Musah is the only thing you watch from this match when he comes off the bench.
Graham, unrelated to that, I just need a quick soundbite. Can you just say he's better than Kieran Tierney for me?
No. You're never getting that out of me.
Fine. All right, well, congratulations to Barcelona from me. Concerned congratulations to Barcelona from Graham and Joe. Gentlemen, we've talked about four different European leagues today. We've talked about four different big-time games. Anything else to be discussed before we call this one a day?
Did anyone see the Vitesse Arnhem fans bouncing so hard that the stand gave way beneath them?
No.
Did anyone see that?
That sounds not good.
Thankfully, everyone seemed like everyone was okay, which was my first thought was,
wow.
Oh dear, that looks terrible. But it seemed like everyone was okay. And the clearest indicator that everyone was okay was that they just continued bouncing.
All right. Well, that's good, I guess, but hopefully all goes well there. But that's some intense fans. Well done, Vitesse. Less so, Vitesse Stadium. But for now, listeners, thank you all so much for listening. Graham Ruthven, thank you so much for joining me today. I will not say the same to Ryan Bailey, but I will say that to you.
No problem, Taylor.
Joe, thank you for taking the time to talk to me about all four games that we talked about today.
You got it, man.
Ryan Bailey, listeners, I'm assuming is off investigating the latest saga in the Wanda Nara scandal with Mauro Icardi. I'm sure he will have thoughts on that later in the week. But for now, thank you all so much for listening. We'll talk to you all again very soon.